Welcome to Case in Point, produced by the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School. My name is Matt Merrin, and I'm the Multimedia Coordinator from the Communications Department. With me today is the Jefferson B. Fordham Professor of Law and Deputy Dean of Alumni Engagement and Inclusion, Tobias Barrington Wolf. He joins us on Case in Point to discuss SCOTUS's 6-3 majority opinion that members of the LGBTQ plus community are protected from workplace discrimination under Title VII. Thanks for being here. Tobias, could you please start by providing a brief history of Title VII?
Sure. Title VII is a provision of a major piece of civil rights legislation called the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which was enacted, as the name suggests, in 1964, took effect in 1965. And it governs discrimination in employment, which means that covered businesses, businesses that are covered by the provisions of the statute, are not allowed to discriminate in hiring, in firing, or in conditions of employment, including things like promotion, based upon a number of different core characteristics, including race, religion, national origin, and sex.
Great. And then in regards to what just passed last week with the Supreme Court, what key factors did SCOTUS base their majority opinion on?
So the holding in the Bostock decision was that the existing language of the Civil Rights Act, and specifically the language that prohibits discrimination because of sex, also prohibits discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. And the fundamental holding of the court was that when we talk about sexual orientation and gender identity, and when a business discriminates against somebody on those grounds, those are distinct categories from sex, but you can't really talk about sexual orientation and gender identity without talking about sex, right? Those categories are defined in terms of sex. So when we talk about sexual orientation, we're talking about the sex or gender of people that you have romantic or sexual connections and feelings for. And when we talk about gender identity, we talk about your gender in relation to the sex that you were assigned at birth, right? And so both of these are categories that deal with distinct issues, but they're distinct issues that are defined with reference to sex. And so what the court held in Bostock was, just like, for example, if you fire somebody for being a single mother, that's a distinct category from the category of woman or the category of sex all by itself. But obviously a policy of firing single mothers is a policy that is disadvantaging people in a way that makes reference to sex. And by the same token, the court said, if you fire somebody for being a lesbian, or if you fire somebody for being transgender, then you're firing them for a reason that makes reference to sex. And that's prohibited by the statute.
Great. And how big of a victory is the Supreme Court decision? And what's symbolic weight of the moment?
Well, it's an extraordinarily significant decision. We don't have explicit employment anti-discrimination protection under federal law that touches that deals with sexual orientation and gender identity. And it's been the case for a long time that LGBT people and civil rights lawyers and increasingly lower federal courts have recognized that the existing language of the Civil Rights Act should give protection to LGBT people in the workplace. And a number of lower federal courts have held that. There was more success and earlier success getting courts to recognize that argument when it came to gender identity. The argument relating to sexual orientation, it's only more recently that lower federal courts have been recognizing the correctness of that argument. But a lot of courts had not recognized it, and a few had actually rejected it. And so what that meant was that LGBT people in the workplace had either no federal protection against employment discrimination, or the protection was uncertain because the Supreme Court had never ruled on the issue. And this ruling means that nationwide, businesses that are big enough to be covered by the Civil Rights Act, which means they have at least 15 employees, are all required to refrain from discriminating against their LGBT employees. And obviously straight people and non-transgender people as well, they're just not usually the ones who get discriminated against based on sexual orientation or gender identity, but the protections apply to everybody. And so in one decision, the court clarified the meaning of a statute that has a pretty big impact on the employment situation and the employment security of LGBT people around the country.
Now, does the language change in Title VII because of this decision? Like, is there an amendment that will say sexual orientation as well, or is it just all wrapped under the word sex?
So nothing changes in the statute other than the court clarifying what the existing language of the statute means, right? I mean, what the court said was, look, this is what the statute already said. And it's just that, you know, lower federal courts had not properly recognized it. And in fact, federal courts don't have the power to change the language of statutes. That's something that only Congress can do. You know, a subsequent Congress, if it wanted to, could enact an amendment to the statute to make those provisions explicit. And what's perhaps more to the point, there's pending legislation in Congress right now called the Equality Act, which does exactly that, but does a bunch of other stuff as well that's quite important. The Civil Rights Act is a phenomenally important piece of legislation. It has some limitations to it. And the Equality Act was seeking to not just extend protections to LGBT people, but also to strengthen the statute in various ways, which I'm happy to describe if you'd like.
Yeah, we'd love that. I mean, please feel free.
Well, so two of the primary places where the Civil Rights Act has some holes in it are, first of all, there's a separate title of the act which relates to so-called public accommodations, right? Businesses in the public marketplace. And that provision of the statute doesn't have any protections against sex discrimination at all. And what's more, the scope of the reach of that provision is actually relatively narrow. It doesn't reach very many businesses. And so when you're out in the public marketplace, shopping at a store, going to a restaurant, going to a hotel, and you suffer discrimination, most of the time, your protection, if you have protection, is going to come from state or local law instead of federal law. And state and local law provide very important protections. But for a long time, people have commented that it would make sense for there to be stronger federal protections against marketplace discrimination as well as workplace discrimination. And so the Equality Act would add sex and sexual orientation and gender identity as protected categories for public accommodations under federal law. And also expand the scope of those protections, expand the number of businesses that are covered. So that would be one big change. And that would be a change in the statutory language, and it's one that the Bostock decision doesn't say anything about at all. And then the second thing is, you know, in recent years, there's been a lot of focus on this federal statute called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And it's a statute that, depending on how you interpret its language, it appears to give religious adherents special exemptions and special rights under federal law to get an exemption from federal law. And there's been a bit of an open question whether that exemption would include the ability to discriminate against people in the workplace, which seems like a really bad idea, but people are making that argument. And so the Equality Act would eliminate that exemption with respect to the Civil Rights Act. It would make it clear that religious belief is not a basis for discriminating in either the workplace or the marketplace.
Interesting. Thank you for that. Was there anything about the decision that surprised you?
So I was less surprised by the decision than a lot of people were. I actually thought it was likely that Justice Gorsuch, who wrote the opinion, one of the conservatives on the court, would come out the way that he did and that he would wind up writing the opinion. Justice Gorsuch has presented himself as a committed textualist, as a judge who first and foremost looks at the language of a statute in isolation. And if he thinks that that gives a clear answer, then he says that's all we need to look at and we don't look at anything else. And the question of whether that's a sensible way to go about interpreting a statute is a complicated one, but that's how he has presented himself. And the textualist argument for what the court did in Bostock is a relatively clear and straightforward one, the one that we started off this conversation with. And a lot of the briefing in the case was really targeted at Justice Gorsuch with the idea that he might find the textualist argument an attractive one. He actually used the opinion, I mean, the result in the opinion is really great. He used the opinion to advance textualism of his particular stripe as the way the court should interpret statutes across the board. And at least for purposes of that decision, he got 6 votes for that. And so that's a pretty consequential fact. I guess the thing that surprised me was that Chief Justice Roberts joined the opinion as well. I thought that was possible. I had a number of conversations with some civil rights friends of mine saying that I thought a 6-3 result was possible. And most of them thought that I was nuts, but a couple of them agreed that it was possible.
Did you win any money in Vegas?
Oh no, I've learned you never bet on results in the Supreme Court. It's a losing proposition.
Fair enough.
But so I certainly saw that it was a possibility, but I wasn't prepared to say that I thought it was likely. I thought the more likely outcome was a 5-4 decision. So I'm glad that it was 6-3.
And just for a layman like myself, do you mind defining textualization?
Textualism. Yeah, what I said just a moment ago. That is, there's a lot of different schools of thought about the best way to interpret a statute. And, you know, language is unavoidably an ambiguous tool. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's only so much specific meaning that you can put into writing at any given time and then have that control and give clear answers to questions that come up when you go on to apply a statute. And one school of thought, for example, one competing school of thought is often described as a purposive interpretation school of thought, which is that you do your best to understand what the purposes of a statute are, what set of goals it's seeking to accomplish, but also what set of values it is seeking to promote. And then insofar as a statute is ambiguous, or at least it's unclear what the answer should be just from the text, you interpret the statute in light of the purposes that Congress was attempting to achieve. And a textualist would resist that and say purposes are too ambiguous themselves or too subject to debate. You should simply always be driven by the text. And if the text is ambiguous, you should do your best to come up with the best interpretation of the text using what they often describe as the public meaning of that text at the time that it was written into law. That is what a sort of average objective person would understand the text to mean at the time that it was written into law. And so those are, you might think of as a more static versus a more dynamic way of understanding ambiguous statutory language. And Justice Gorsuch generally takes the more static, pure textualist approach.
Great. Thank you for that. Yeah, it's fascinating because they're supposed to keep their political affiliations out of it. And it just seems like these cases, they take on such a philosophical weight and depth once it makes it across their desks. It's very interesting to kind of think about.
Well, and, you know, I mean, politics in the sense that there's a political party and you want to advance the goals of that political party, I think you're quite right. It's not appropriate for courts to think that way at all. I think that there are a distressing number of judges who do think that way. And frankly, I think in the present judiciary, it is more frequently conservative judges who think that way. But I think, you know, you see that on the left and in the center as well. And I think it's always the wrong way to go. Now, that's a different conversation from talking about statutes or the Constitution embodying certain values. And that part of the job of a judge is to interpret the language of a statute or the language of the Constitution to advance those values. Mm-hmm. And I think that's unavoidable, right? I mean, everybody agrees that the Constitution embodies certain types of values. Some of them are explicitly laid out in the Constitution, and some of them are so clearly a part of the history and purpose of the Constitution that they enjoy, you know, widespread agreement. Where we tend to have disagreement is where questions of values come up in constitutional questions or in statutory questions. And it's not, you know, there's not as much consensus about what those values that animate the analysis should be. And those are difficult cases, and they're cases that often provoke a lot of disagreement. It's not necessarily a sign that anybody is engaged in any kind of illegitimate judging. Mm-hmm. Those are simply cases where there's a difference of understanding about what values animate the Constitution or the statute. So when judges appear to be acting to simply advance the interests of a political party, that is obviously improper. But when they are acting in a way which shows a consistent understanding of the values that should animate their analysis in different types of cases, no matter how the case winds up coming out, there's nothing illegitimate about that. That's just the process of judging.
So where does the movement for LGBTQ plus equality go from here? Is there a next stop on the train?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of work ahead. I guess one area that I think is urgently important is to look at the intersection of LGBT issues and questions of race and class, and the ways in which both racial discrimination and poverty or economic inequality can have, you know, a kind of synergistic impact. There's a much greater degree of vulnerability that LGBT people experience when they also are contending with racism, when they're also contending with economic inequality. And I think the movement has, there's certainly a lot of people and organizations that care a great deal about that set of issues. I think the movement as a whole has not done as much work as it needs to in framing its goals around addressing those sort of overlapping sources of inequality. And my hope is that in the moment of sort of nationwide conversation that we're in right now about racial equality and economic justice, that the LGBT movement is going to be both a participant and maybe in some ways a leader on those issues as well.
Great. And then for individuals who want to find out more about the LGBTQ community, maybe just great resources for civil rights in general, what do you recommend?
Well, a lot of the most important activism is, I think, being done by young people. There are major sort of legacy civil rights organizations that do both litigation and public policy work. The National Center for Lesbian Rights, the ACLU, Lambda, the Transgender Legal Defense Fund, you know, any number of such organizations. And they do great work. And they are showing a lot of leadership when it comes to formal policy. So any of the websites of those organizations would be great places to look for that kind of information. But in thinking about, you know, cultural change and thinking about social disagreement, right? I mean, the way in which people lead their lives on a day-to-day basis. I think that you should, you know, find the voices of young activists who are defining new conversations. And, you know, a law professor at Penn is not the right person to ask about which of those voices are the most important. But they're the ones who are driving a lot of the conversation forward and really expanding our understanding of what's possible.
As a professor, as a gay professor at the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School, and just over your time working in the legal field, what does all this mean to you personally?
Well, it means a lot. I mean, you know, I have a very clear understanding in the work that I do on LGBTQ issues that my status as a citizen and my ability to, you know, pursue my own life plans and life goals, including getting married, are very directly implicated by this work and by actions by courts and legislatures to recognize the equal status of LGBTQ people. And I remember very clearly the first time that I read a couple of the major Supreme Court opinions that recognized the rights of gay, lesbian, and bisexual people, for example. Or the time that I got to attend the signing ceremony when President Obama repealed the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy in the military. Those were incredibly emotional moments for me. And they were emotional for me because my equality and my citizenship status was being recognized by my government in a way that had not happened before. I was a law student about 25 years ago. And when I was a law student, the then current state of the law was that gay people, gay, lesbian, and bisexual people could be put in jail for having sex. And that was a pretty profound fact and could easily make one feel a little bit hopeless about prospects for the future. But it just gave us a challenge and we buckled down and did a lot of the work. We being, you know, lawyers and advocates and ordinary people leading their lives and refusing to be intimidated away from seeking love and seeking partnership. And we've come very far and we have a lot further to go, but we've come very far.
Is there anything that you'd like to say while I have you here? Anything I didn't ask you?
No, I think we covered it. I mean, I guess I'll just reiterate something I said a few moments ago, which is that this is definitely a phenomenally important ruling. And in very concrete terms, what it means is that gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, queer people are going to be able to enter the workplace on equal terms. And we've had those protections in place against race discrimination and against sex discrimination, meaning discrimination against women or men. We've had those protections in place for, at this point, 55 years. And we all know that that doesn't mean there's no racism in the workplace, that there's no sexual harassment in the workplace. But what it does mean is that when racism or sexism happen in the workplace, there's a remedy. And not only is there a remedy, but there's a broad understanding and agreement that that is wrong. And part of what I hope this decision will begin is a process of advancing that kind of shared understanding that when homophobia, when transphobia happens in the workplace, and it's going to keep on happening, that there's going to be a remedy for it for the people who have been injured. And there's going to be a growing agreement, and there's already very broad agreement if, you know, when you look at polling information, but a growing understanding that that kind of discrimination in the workplace is wrong. And, you know, the law can have that kind of guiding effect in generating a certain kind of formalization of a social consensus. I don't think law can create social consensus out of nothing, but I think law can help to organize and formalize social consensus. And my hope is that that's what it will do here.
Thanks a lot, Tobias. This was a great conversation. I really appreciate you spending some time with Case in Point this afternoon, and I hope you have a great day.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure. You too.